good are you as a prompter on a scale from 1 to 10, with 1 being totally amateur and 10 being world-class? Kate Sewell is a director of technical product management for Granite. Kate, welcome back to the show. Prompting, how are you at it?
Prompting is never something I want to be known for, but I do think I'm pretty good at it. So maybe like an 8.
Okay, cool. Nice. Chris Hay, Distinguished Engineer, CTO Customer Transformation. Chris, welcome to the show. Your prompting score.
As a large language model, I could not possibly answer that question.
Got it. And last but not least is Aaron Bautman, IBM Fellow and Master Inventor. Aaron, your prompting skill, please.
Does prompt engineering really exist? Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I always ask LLMs to produce a prompt for me.
Okay, everybody's fighting the question. All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts, a Think podcast. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together the sharpest team of researchers, engineers, and product leaders you'll find anywhere in the world of podcasting to discuss and debate the biggest news in artificial intelligence. As always, there's a ton to talk about. We're going to talk about Rick Rubin's collaboration with Anthropic, Joni Ive with OpenAI, Microsoft's new agent factory theory. But first, I really want to start by talking about the Claude 4 system prompt. So you may have gotten our emergency episode where we did a quick review of the release of Claude 4. And true to form, pretty soon afterwards, the system prompt leaked. I think that's kind of just almost standard practice now. It was pretty interesting. Simon Willenson did a super interesting blog post where he sort of annotated the system prompt. And I think in general, I wanted to kind of get this group together because we haven't talked about prompting in some time, but it's also just an interesting document as kind of like a state of the art on where prompting is at the moment. Chris, I'll start with you. Curious if there's anything that kind of stuck out to you reading this prompt that you felt was different or really kind of indicated where, you know, kind of the state of the practice was in prompting.
I always find the Claude system prompts super interesting because, one, they are very transparent about it as well. They publish it. I mean, there is some stuff they don't publish, but they're pretty transparent about that. But it's long. I mean, this is not a short system prompt, right? So if you think, question, how good are we at system prompting? This thing is pages and pages long. So Anthropic are really giving you an education themselves on how to system prompt, how to prompt properly. So I think it's pretty good. There are a few things that I think is super interesting about it. The first one is probably just simple things like guidance on how it wants to answer. It's like, you know, if it's a short thing, please just answer there. Don't use artifacts in this case, etc. There's a lot of guidance perspective, and then how to deal with personality as well. And, you know, if it's a sensitive topic, blah, blah, blah. But I think the thing that probably makes me laugh the most is how it always talks to Claude in the third party, you know, Claude, you should do this. Claude, you should do that. Claude, you should do this. And you know, and poor AI is going to have an existential crisis already, you know, thinking in a third party form. But I think it is worthwhile everybody checking out that system prompt because you can learn a lot from it. And then I remember last year when Claude 3 had just came out, I think it was the Claude 3.5 models at that point. One of the videos I once did was I took the Claude 3.5 system prompts, and then I put them on top of the Llama models. And I'm going to be honest, even though those system prompts were designed for the Claude models, they actually improved the Llama models as well. So I honestly, I think it's something everybody should really read up on. It will help them.
Yeah, for sure. So there's a lot there. And Kate, maybe I'll turn to you. I mean, taking Chris's first point, I thought one of the most interesting things in the prompt was the degree to which it really feels like in prompting, we're trying to figure out how much we need to specify versus like leave up to the knowledge of the model. So there's this interesting quote where it's like, Claude should be cognizant of red flags in the person's message and avoid responding in ways that could be harmful. And part of Simon's annotation is like, it just has a notion of what red flags are. And curious about like how you think about that. I know Chris is saying that these prompts are very long, but it almost kind of presages a world where, you know, we can increasingly sort of rely on model knowledge and keep prompts almost sort of short. But curious how you think about that.
Yeah, you know, I think what surprised me most was just how much of the Claude, you know, experience they're leaving up to a single prompt versus breaking some of these things down into more granular steps. So you mentioned red flags and you're saying, you know, all right, Claude, pretty please don't include, you know, don't respond to red flags, whatever red flags might be. And you could easily envision a different experience that Anthropic could have built where first there's a step where there's literal screening by a model whose only job is to screen for red flags or any other risks or harm and biases. And they might still be doing this behind the scenes. But, you know, I think where I see a lot of the world starting to move and where I'd would have expected Anthropic to go a little bit more with Claude 4 and they didn't, is dividing this up into more steps, running more inferences and leaving less to kind of a really long essay that you have to maintain. And, you know, you do basically like security on a prayer, like pretty, pretty please, will you, you know, not respond to harmful content, not respond to messages, instead have more verifiable checks and balances that you can kind of articulate via software and more programmatic functions that you're checking.
Yeah, for sure. And Aaron, I guess to take the other side of kind of Chris's response to that first question, you know, you opened up with the around the horn question by saying, like, I don't actually really do much prompting at all, you know. And I think Chris is, you know, kind of almost taking the view that's like, it's good for us to kind of like read and understand what's going on here. But I don't know if you'd say this is maybe a little bit too aggressive, but like, is it worth it for us to kind of study these prompts as someone who just kind of like gets models to generate them for him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's sort of two schools of thoughts here, right? You know, should these prompts, you know, be released or not? You know, and if they're not released, then they're potentially going to be leaked anyways, you know? And I think one of the schools of thought is we should release the prompts, you know, because it's proof, you know, that AI can be incredibly smart, but it can still completely misunderstand the assignment or what you're telling it to do, unless you understand like that manual of how to use the LLM. Right. But on the other hand, maybe you don't want to release the prompts because, you know, AI could be like this new intern, right? Where it's eager, unpredictable, but somehow it's already running the company. Right. And so we have to be very careful about releasing too much. And then in the leaking part of this, right, from what I saw, it looked like that Anthropic did release some of the system prompts, but what was really leaked were the tools part, you know, which could be very dangerous, you know. And so the notion that, you know, do people need to read, you know, these manuals to understand how to use LLMs from the expert level, you know, when you ask, are you 1 to 10, if you're like an 8 to 10, you know, then I think it's good to study it, right? If you're down on the lower end, 1, 3, maybe not. But I do think that, you know, whether or not these prompts, you know, are going to be released or not, right, is sort of up in the air, you know, of, you know, should it or should it not? And there are a lot of inherent risk, right, about exposing, you know, these prompts, but there's also benefits.
I think it's not a bad thing, though. I mean, to sort of come back to Aaron's point and Kate's for a second, right? It's like, it's more of a handbook and a guide for the model. The model's going to learn loads and loads of things over time and it's going to be put in different situations. But like us as humans, we're in different situations. How I act at a party is going to be different to how I act to this podcast, right? So before we came onto this podcast, our wonderful producer was like, Tim, make your bed. Chris, sit up straight. You know, put your camera down. Da, 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 da. Here is the guide for how you should behave in this scenario. And that's different in other scenarios. So I think it's okay for them to say, you know what, you're not in an enterprise setting at the moment. And remember, the Claude model is going to be doing enterprisey stuff. Maybe it's going to be doing research, etc. You are now acting as a general chatbot. You're answering general queries. And that means average human beings don't want to hear you waffling on about, you know, life, et cetera, and what you think of this book. It wants it in a couple of paragraphs, and it doesn't want you hallucinating things. It wants you to go and use the web tool and go come back with the answers. So I think it's okay to have that in a system prompt to guide like a handbook of how it should behave in that case. And because that's how we deal with things as well, right? In different scenarios, we have different guides of how we should behave.
Yeah. And I think one of the most interesting things here, and it goes back to what Kay and I were just talking a moment ago about, is like, you know, originally I think the idea of these prompts was to specify in detail, right? Like what you wanted the model to do. And I always remember the joke I had with a friend was like, are we just rebuilding programming? Where you're like, you have to just like say really specifically what you want the computer to do. But, you know, there's another quote that I had written down here. So one of the elements in the prompt is, if thinking mode is interleaved or auto, then after function results, you should strongly consider outputting a thinking block. It was like kind of this very funny thing where you're like, okay, now the model has thinking mode. But rather than saying like under these specific conditions, engage it, it's just like you should strongly consider it, right? And it's sort of interesting on like the degree to which these prompts like are actually giving us control over what the models are doing or versus us just like kind of like giving it vague rules. I don't know if Kate, you want to respond there.
Well, I mean, like maybe the what might look like control. I think the other thing is like how much have we really tested? And if you don't release system prompts, it's really hard for the academic community to do research and to validate some of this. but how thoroughly have we really tested if every single line of that system prompt actually has the intended effect? What is the degradation in performance and how often the model produces thinking if that line is there or is not? I see prompts all the time where, you know, people write them based off of like one weird edge case. And so they add a line and that one weird edge case disappears. But do they really impact the model behavior as a whole across, you know, everything that you're trying to impact and study? So I think there's also some degree of wishful thinking with system prompts where the model's been trained for a lot of these behaviors already, like when to do thinking and all sorts of stuff. You know, I think we're trying to nudge and steer, but it also makes it seem like, oh, well, if I told the model X, Y, and Z, then X, Y, and Z will happen because I gave it this nice little playbook. And I think it gives us a false degree of security that that is actually going to be followed. And I think a lot of these system prompts are probably way too long if you actually want something that really is like, there should almost be standards of, is this system prompt certified to impact this type of behavior and the degree that it specifies.
And I do think there's a balance, right? That, you know, going back to tool calling, function calling, right, is that there's a huge inherent risk, I think, of leaking those types of prompts, right? Because depending upon the use case, for example, on the extreme, if you're doing like robotic surgery, right, and somebody could have a tool call, right, and hack the tool call and bypass different types of, let's say, refinements, right? They could do jailbreaking refinements, bypass content moderation, force different types of searching, right? Which could have catastrophic, you know, impacts on the patient, right? So those types of, I think, system prompts could be obfuscated. They could be encrypted within fragments such that they're not there, you know, to be used, right? Yet, you know, because I don't think some behavior, right, should be enabled, right? And released, like if you're filing taxes or if you're sending an email, right? Not you, but the LLM or Gen AI doing that, right? I certainly wouldn't want it to, oops, sorry, Kate, I sent an email on your behalf, you know, because I hacked in, you know, this certain tool call or function call, right? So I ghosted her, right? So, so those types of more extreme, right, exploitations, I think, just need to be carefully thought of. And I thought Anthropic was taking that into account by not releasing some of those system prompting elements within their original sort of manual, right? But then they were leaked anyways, right? So there's always, you know, this that risk and balance that I think we all need to just think about.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, I don't know, the layers of obfuscation here, I think, will get very interesting because at the end of the day, it's just tokens, right? And so you can imagine constructing a prompt where a human reads it and is like, oh, well, these are the rules that guide the system, but actually, like, you know, impose certain other kinds of not written behavior on the model, which I think will be like a really interesting, you know, next development if it hasn't already happened, right? Because all these companies know that the system prompt's just going to get leaked within hours of the model coming out. So I'm going to move us on to our next segment. Really interesting collaboration dropped between legendary music producer Rick Rubin and Anthropic. They dropped this kind of document on thewayofcode.com. And what it appears to be is a rewrite of the Tao Te Ching, but about vibe coding. This is like both a very funny kind of collaboration in some ways and made me think a little bit about this kind of famous interview that Rick Rubin did with 60 Minutes. Where he said, I have no technical capability and I know nothing about music. And he took a lot of, you know, criticism for this, being, you know, the legendary music producer that he is. But I kind of love this because it sort of asks the question for vibe coding about like just how far vibe coding will go and whether or not in the future we really will have Rick Rubin-like producers for code. In the same way that we have for music, where it's really unclear like what Rick Rubin's skill is. He just appears to be really good at getting number one hits. I don't know, maybe Aaron, I'll throw it to you first, is like, do you feel like in the future of vibe coding, like we'll see people with zero technical ability be able to do incredible things with computers, just given where things are going with code gen?
Yeah, I mean, there's a continuum here, right? And you know, as an engineer and scientist, right, I do believe that the mind gets into like these different patterns and constructs pathways as one develops and codes and builds, right? And you can think of it as like a flow state, right? And then if someone just walks into your office, right, when you're in the middle of it, it's sort of like your flow state collapses and you got to start all over and rebuild those constructs, right? And so that to me is kind of like this vibe coding. But I think the way that Rick, is approaching this is it's more of an art form or like this cultural phenomenon, you know, where, you know, I did visit his Way of Code site, right? And looked, and it looked like you could go in and actually personalize some of like the graphics and such, you know, that he already sort of seeded with a vibe coding element, right? So I think in short, you know, if you are building like a production application that needs to be at scale, I think pairing vibe coding with good engineering, you know, is very important. But if you're just doing it for, a prototype to build an experience that doesn't have to be so precise, maybe this kind of style of vibe coding, you know, is the way to go.
Okay, any responses to this? I know it's always this kind of push-pull, right? I mean, I think Aaron's response has a lot in there, is where it's like, well, this is good, but like we might need real engineering at some point. But curious about what you thought reading through The Way of Code.
Yeah, you know, I think in many ways, you know, coding can be viewed reasonably so as an art form. It's creating in kind of the act of creation, I think, is inherently artistic and creative. And so from that perspective, I think there is something interesting about how do we unlock future developers who don't have the same backgrounds, who bring different experiences, to find new ways to solve some of the thorny, challenging problems. And I think that's kind of the spirit that Rick is coming from that I've seen. But I also, you know, think if we talk about critical infrastructure and, you know, what the world runs on, like, you know, there's a big difference between art and, mainframe systems that run, you know, all of the financial transactions in the world. And, you know, there's different degrees of reliability and trust and everything else. So, you know, I think it's important to make sure that there's kind of a balanced approach at the end of the day. It's not saying the world is going to be vibe coding and only vibe coding, but how do we use this rather as a tool to engage more with the community, with people who come from less traditional backgrounds that traditionally don't know how to code, but could bring really new, unusual, and powerful ideas that could be, if, you know, are being going to be implemented in some sort of critical capacity, implemented maybe with more knowledgeable traditional means.
Yeah, I love that, how basically, you know, maybe in an earlier era kind of computer code, you sort of couldn't approach in an artistic manner. But we're now living in a world where like almost the boundaries of that are a little expanded. And so you can approach it as if you were, you know, sort of a music producer or just kind of like vibing with it. Chris, responses? I saw you went off mute here.
Yeah, I love it, actually, because I do think programming is an art form. I know we want it to be a science, but I do think it is art. So, and I do love the idea of exploration and being able just to kind of figure things out. So I don't think we always need to take an engineering approach. And again, if I think of architecture, I don't mean computer architecture like we do. I'm meaning as in people with pencils and beards and flip-flops and things like that, right? I don't know. But you know, if somebody came in and went, I want to design a new house, and, you know, and then they start and sort of drew a picture, and now there's your new house, you'd be like, huh, should I give that to the builder? And they'd be like, sure. And you'd be like, I don't think that house is going to work. But that's fine. But if you then got the technical schematic architect to just build that, then, you know, they're going to be following the process. You know, this joist needs to connect to this. I don't know any about building terms. Joist, I think, is the only one I know.
And that's like a thing that houses have.
Exactly. And a roof and stuff. And then there'll be, but where's the creativity? That's not going to create the Guggenheim or something like that. There you go. I was trying to think of something that was a fancy
that's
building.
An art thing, but, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So I think you got to have that mix. And I think it's almost the same as like music production, right? So in Rick Rubin's case, right? It's just like, I think vibe coding allows you to break things down into their individual elements and then recompose them, right? And then I think that's okay to then take that to an engineered state. But I think that whole process of creativity is a good thing. So I'm a big fan of vibe coding because you can test out ideas really quickly and explore it. And then you can go and engineer the parts that you need to engineer and get a little bit more process oriented about it. But why kill the creativity? So I love it. I'm a huge vibe coder and I love the collaboration.
Kate, this makes me think a little bit about like how vibe coding is going to evolve within an organization or within an enterprise. You know, in all the companies I've worked for, there's always been like a little bit of like a class system, right, between like the designers and the engineers. And the designers were like, here's a mock-up that you should build. And the engineers are like, we have to build it. And like, like all these people with their crazy designs. And it kind of feels like what vibe coding is going to allow, like what will change is that like designers can suddenly build workable prototypes. And so like there's a whole degree to which like this allows a group of people within a company to kind of like seize the means of production in a way that I think might be like deeply disruptive to kind of like the natural state of affairs that has kind of presided over these companies. And that feels like it's going to be really interesting to watch.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it can go both ways, though, because I think designers or whoever is trying to test the waters and who always say, oh, go build this. You know, it should be easy. Just put this button over there and then you'll be fine. And that button should do all these other things, by the way. And oh, it also needs to be compliant X, Y, Z. And so they'll try it and undoubtedly it will fail if they just kind of vibe code and throw it out into the world. When it hits real production and learn some pretty nasty lessons that it's actually really complicated. And there's a lot of important work that, you know, developers are doing behind the scenes. So, you know, I think it's just going to probably be really important, though, as a communication tool to help better articulate vision, to help better explain what you're looking for or what the target goal is, to help iterate faster on proof of concepts and, you know, experiment faster. So I think it definitely will disrupt from those perspectives.
Yeah. And it actually occurs to me as you're talking that like the annoyance will work both ways, right? Because suddenly engineers can be like, oh, I generated this picture of the website I wanted you to create. It's like everybody's going to be Aaron and like in everybody else's business, it seems like, Aaron.
Yeah, I mean, this whole notion of vibe coding to me is very similar to inventing, right? Because it's, you know, you get lots of people together, and you need different perspectives. You need the artfulness of creating novelty, but you also need the engineering to make sure it's implementable and it can be used in some kind of embodiment, right? And vibe coding to me is very similar, where you get, you know, the creatives together. It's a blur. It becomes more of a blur where the scientists and creative now become one, right? Because you're vibing to sort of do like this vibe science or vibe engineering, you know, to have these alternative hypotheses. You know, it's like exploring different branches very quickly. And then when you need to get into an embodiment, then you build, right? And then implement, you know. So I think some of the white space here would be, how do we connect vibe coding to the actual build, implementation, right? And deployment of something that's practical, that's usable, that can handle high scale and load, some of the really hard challenges, right, that we face every day, right? So I'm pretty excited about that area, which I think is just beginning to emerge a bit.
So for our third segment, we're actually going to do another design and AI story in some ways. The biggest business story of really the last week or two in AI has been this enormous $6 billion plus acquisition of Joni Ive's secretive startup, IO. And Joni Ive, if you don't know, was most famously the chief architect of the iPhone and kind of like the sort of design mind between Apple during kind of a whole era of its history. And the announcement is that Joni Ive himself is going to go collaborate with OpenAI on hardware through a design collective that he owns. And so this is a huge transaction, right? Billions of dollars. And, you know, I guess, Chris, maybe to turn it to you, like, is it worth it? There's not even a product here. And they're putting $6 billion down. How do you think about why OpenAI would do this and if it really is going to pay out for them in the end?
I hope for $6 billion, he does more than collaborate for them. That seems a huge bill for collaboration. Do you know what I mean? I'm collaborating with you guys just now, and I'm not paying $6 billion.
So Sorry about that, Chris.
I would be more worried if they paid $6 billion and Johnny Ive went, you can have my company, but I'm out of here. You're hearing nothing from me. You'd be like, what am I buying at this point? You know, so I think the whole thing, I mean, Joni Ive's incredible. I really do think. And therefore, you're buying his talent, you're buying his brand, et cetera. So I do think it's going to go beyond collaboration. And I think it's really going to be about shaping the ideas that form what the future of AI is going to look like. Because if we actually truly think about where we are, we're now in this sort of multimodal world. We've got AI is becoming cheaper, you know, being able to run on device. So there's new form factors that need to be discovered to, you know, to have AI in the right place. All right, how do I want to interact in that world? How is the world of agents? Yeah, I said it. How is the world of agents going to behave? How does the future of web look like for that? How does the future of mobile devices? I think there's a lot of things to really work out and discover. And does that mean that how we interact today is going to change? And I think it will change. So actually, being able to bring together AI companies and design companies together to go and figure out what that future looks like and experiment, I really think that is a smart move. And have somebody like Johnny Ive, who is, has been through those transformations before, I think is a very sensible thing. So I think it's an exciting collaboration. And I kind of look forward to what this kind of next wave of experience design for AI is going to look like.
Yeah. And Kate, actually, to give them a little more credit, like this is more than just like a vibe acquisition in some ways. I was like curious. So there has been some details kind of leaked or rumored about what it is that they're working on. And as far as we can tell, it's a kind of like AI device with no screens. That's kind of their pitch. That's pretty interesting, right? We've really built, you know, a whole digital paradigm on screens. And so the idea that we'd go completely no screen in the future, thanks to AI, is pretty surprising, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it's very surprising. But, you know, I think it also kind of gives vibes of some of the AI companion type things we've seen, like, and nobody wants just basically to be accused of making a Tamagotchi where you've got a tiny little screen companion, you know, that you have to feed, otherwise it dies. So, you know, I think they're probably going to lean into some sort of this like life assistant route, doesn't need eyes, you know, or if it does need eyes, it doesn't need a screen to communicate with you, right? We've got better tools now that they're working on, but it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. You know, I've struggled to see that they won't be some sort of like phone app experience as well that connects to whatever device they're also working on.
Yeah, it's hard to untether from that completely. Yeah, Aaron, how do you size it up? I mean, so the most obvious precedent for something like this is the humane pin, which I think we were talking about a year ago, right? Which is like a screenless device that you wear that's always on, that is kind of like an AI assistant in your life. And, you know, one point of view is like, no one wants that. And that's why it didn't work. There's another point of view, which is the technology kind of wasn't there, and we might finally be there. I don't know if a year later is enough time, but obviously things are changing very quickly in AI.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit stuck on, you know, that this is one of the largest deals for 55 employees, right? That's what it is, that at least that we know of. And if I do the math, right, that's what, about 118 million-ish per employee that you're paying for? I mean, that's, you know, pretty good. It's a high stakes bet on this talent, basically, because the valuation, right, is very speculative, because I don't think that this company has created a user base or any devices at all. Right. So it's basically a high stakes bet on design talent, right, for these 55 employees. Right. But if it goes right, creating these AI companions, you know, so I saw that Sam Altman, they wanted to release, what, 100 million of these AI companions. Right. I mean, roughly about that, you know, and if they can pull it off, I mean, they can sell these very cheaply to get back, you know, their 6.5, you know, billion-dollar investment here. Right. But again, you know, I just want to see something tangible, right, very quickly. And I think that they can pull it off, right? Right. I think their mission is in the right place. And I would just say, you know, Apple, you know, watch out, you know, Apple Intelligence, you know, you need to get that going quickly, right? Because I think if OpenAI, you know, works with Ivy here, then, you know, then these AI companions could really, you know, be a nice bet to understand what's happening in one's life without having a screen, perhaps, or, you know, maybe you're going to extend to an already existing screen, right? That's already there. But these different form factors, I think, is going to be really, really interesting, and combining these cutting edge AI experiences, right, is going to be fascinating to watch as the field emerges.
One thing, though, Aaron, that I think Apple does well, they definitely need to catch up. I think you're right. But as we talk about why some of the past assistants have failed and what I think OpenAI will struggle with, is still this notion of privacy and trust with data. Like, I think another reason why the AI virtual assistant companions I mean, there was plenty of things that were done for on edge, you know, type learning, but it is just still this like shadiness factor of like, why are my life's now being recorded and being beamed up to, you know, some machine and AI intelligence. And I don't know that OpenAI is best suited to crack that. So it'll be interesting to see if the new design team can help and think through new ways to design for trust. I think that's something Apple does have as a better starting position if they can figure out, you know, some of their Apple intelligence work, what they're doing there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think the paradigm shift that is implied for OpenAI to get this right, I think is really hard. Because I think it's more than just devices. It's more consumer trust. And how do you ensure that from a technical standpoint? And it's like a whole nother way of thinking about this stuff.
I don't know. I think we overthink trust sometimes, you know? I mean, I know we want trust, etc. But it's a trade, isn't it? It's like, here is the functionality that I'm going to get. How better is my life going to be? Think of the hundreds of millions of people are using ChatGPT every day, right? And everybody knows that you're giving away your data, but you know what? It is, you're getting utility from that. So everybody's kind of prepared to make that payment or not. And some things you're not going to make that payment for and say, okay, I don't trust that. And you'll lean into something and say, well, you know, the Apple approach in this case is gonna be important. And you might lean into that direction. But I think everybody sort of takes that utility, and we understand that we're giving a bunch of data away. Personally, I find it very unlikely I'm going to give up my iPhone. I love my iPhone. I love my iPad. Everything is connected, all of my movies. And this thing doesn't have a screen. What am I going to play my movie on? So I think there is a whole point about ecosystem. Things don't exist within islands, actually. And the thing that Apple does very well is they have a very good ecosystem of platforms and devices, right, where everything connects well. And therefore, if they're making a move into that space, and I think they will do very well, is you have to bring the ecosystem along with you. Because actually, back to the point about that pin thing, right? That didn't connect into anything. So it sat on an island. So I think that's really going to be the problem OpenAI has to think about is what ecosystem are you going to plug into? And guess what? The only two choices in this case are Apple and Google. So, you know, so you got to start figuring this out because if you can't plug into that ecosystem, you're going to have a problem.
All right. So Chris already beat me to it by saying the word agent, but we'd be remiss if we didn't do a story about agents. So I'm going to close up today with our last segment. Super interesting Verge interview that popped up with Jay Parikh, who was the former engineering lead over at Meta, and is now over at Microsoft working on all things agents for them. And we haven't heard from Jay in a little while. I think we talked about him on the show when he first joined Microsoft. And so, you know, I thought it'd be useful to kind of check back in on what he's been working on and to talk a little bit about Microsoft's strategy in the space. I think the most interesting part of the interview, he had this quote. He said, "I want our platform," meaning the Microsoft platform, "for any enterprise or any organization to be able to be the thing they turn into their own agent factory." So the idea is like, whatever you're building, you're going to be able to turn it into an agent using Microsoft tools. And we've talked about this. This came up on last week's episode as well, which is that, you know, it's a little bit of a joke that agent means everything. And I think one way of thinking about what these companies are doing is that they're all battling for like what an agent even is. So, you know, for Google I/O, everybody was saying, oh, well, their version of agent is like search. It's like not that surprising because they're a search company. And I guess Microsoft is kind of articulating a new vision, or their own vision, if you will, on how agents should work, which is very much kind of like, you know, not really a platform, but like every enterprise being its own manufacturing kind of facility for agents. I guess, Kate, maybe I'll turn to you. Is like, it assumes a world where these things become really commodified and really democratized. Do you see that happening, right? Like soon? Is that a realistic way to think about where the market is going?
Yeah, I mean, I think we see also a lot of other industry players that are putting some pressure on Microsoft to do similar. Like we've got the agent force from Salesforce, you know, everyone's coming up with a suite of pre-canned agents. WatsonX announced a bunch of agents at Think just this past conference. And so I think Microsoft's training just to better speak the language of what all of our enterprise users and customers have been trained to speak, which is, I need agents. I need agents now. Everything I can build can be built as an agent, and trying to make sure that they're hyper targeted towards this kind of modality for how people are trying to build and starting to build. And I think it is very much being democratized as we start to see a lot of performances for useful enterprise tasks converge. Any model can do a lot of the things that drive, 80% of the value for these companies. So the ability to build your own, to swap out parts, to customize, I think is going to be critical as people continue to look to how to avoid getting locked into just kind of one endpoint and, ultimately continuing to innovate within their own four walls of their company on how to use their data to create value.
Yeah, Aaron, there's almost a question here, I think, about almost the ceiling on commodifiable agents. We talk a lot about, I think, on this show about how complex it is to orchestrate agents to work properly. You need the right protocols and you need the tasks to be done in the right way and it needs to be fine-tuned and evaled. The skepticism I've always had is it just seems like not every enterprise just has people who know how to do that out of the box. But I guess Kate's, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're almost kind of arguing that there's enough kind of common tasks that the sort of out of the box agent will be something that most enterprises will be able to play with. How do you think that market's going to evolve? It sort of feels like it's going to go in two directions almost over time.
Whenever I think about agents, the first thought that pops in my mind is James Bond, 007, right? He's the ultimate agent, right? And we need to watch out for double agents and make sure that we can ensure that they don't go rogue, right? And I was looking at this and, what this agent factory has, it's like it has this a service. It uses agent identity and governance, where it can provide identification for each of the agents, right? Such that you can't go get a fake ID and, maybe doppelganger, another agent and go do something else, right? It's got observability management, low code, no code tools. But I think everybody in industry is trying to do, get in the game, AI agents, which they should be. But I think for Microsoft, one of the biggest differentiators that I see, I happened to look 2 weeks ago, I look every now and then at it's called the top500.org. It's this website that tells you the fastest supercomputers in the world. And I was curious, was cloud on there, right? And I think it was the number four, the fourth ranked one was called Eagle, right? And it runs and built on Azure, right? So it's a cloud-based supercomputer, which, I didn't think I would see that, right, happen so quickly that, wow, okay, so this isn't like a blue gene, a particular piece of hardware, right? So to me, the compute power that Azure, that Microsoft has on Azure, I think really can give them, a nice opportunity here. They have data sources. They can integrate with Windows. They already have what Azure AI Copilot pieces. They can expand into consumer markets, with Windows Copilot. So I think they have sort of the bread and butter elements, right, to make this AI agent factory happen. It's just hopefully they can release some of these features to map to their vision of how they're going to do it so we can avoid these double agents.
Yeah, for sure. And Chris, it looks like you're about to jump in. I mean, if I can kind of maybe prompt you with a question. We talk a lot about who's going to win in the agent market. There's almost a part of me that kind of thinks about Aaron's comment and is maybe actually over time, the agent market is just going to divide up, right? That it'll just turn out that if you have a task that really requires search, you'll be using Google's agents, but you may not really need all those capabilities. And so you'll maybe you really are more married to the Azure infrastructure. And so you use Microsoft. It may not be winner take all in this market. I don't know if that was what you're going to address, but
I don't think it will be winner take all, and I'm happy to kind of say that, because one of the big things that's really happening in the market at the moment is the commoditization. So if we really think about what's going on here, all of the major providers have hooked onto Model Context Protocol (MCP) as the standard for remote tool calling. And I think that's a good thing, right? Because we're going to move into this this world where we want to be built on composition. So if everybody's at least standardizing on tools, then there can be a marketplace of tools. And it also means the models can be trained to work with those tools very well. And therefore, if you want to shift to a different agent for whatever reason, then guess what? You can bring your tools along with that. And I think in the factory context, this makes sense as well, right? So from a factory perspective, I'm going to want to build something, right? But actually, maybe 80% of the tools already exist, and maybe 80% of the agents that can work with those tools already exist. And I really need to do the 20%, whereas in the previous world, I would have had to do all of that. So I think that becomes important. And then with things like 8OA and ACP. So having agent protocols where you can have a standardized way of having agents be able to talk to each other. And again, whether it's Salesforce, Microsoft, et cetera, they're all landing on protocols for that interoperability. So I think that moves us into a marketplace again. So I think as soon as you start to get in this world of marketplaces and you have this area of standardization, then I hope that that means we get away from this winner-takes-all market and then folks can specialize on the things that they're really good at and their differentiation. The good news and probably the bad news at the same time is actually, I think this brings us back into the discussion we had at the beginning, which is about vibe coding. Because actually, if I've got the engineering of agents that do tasks really well, and I've got tools that do things really well, and models have done that, and then agents know how to talk to each other, and we all know how to talk to models, etc., then actually vibe coding becomes quite interesting in the world of factories, because then I can sort of vibe up what I want, and then I can hand it across to some agents who are going to do a productionized version and use productionized tools, and it completes that circle. So I know we were talking about vibe coding being a toy, but actually I want you to think about that factory model for a second that kind of Microsoft's discussing. And I think those two worlds blend over time.
I can also envision a world where we have these AI agent skills marketplaces, you know. So, you know, if we use these new approaches, so we just released what's called Allura. I think it's activated low rank adaptation, where you have like these weights that go that can influence the attention, right? So your weight matrices that project and create, whether it's your keys, your queries, your values, right? But they can be fine-tuned to what kind of skill you would like, right? And then you save those weights and you can dynamically on the fly import that skill so that now that same model of which the same model topology of which you created your Allura weights now has a different behavior. Right. So this decentralization of skills is there, and you could vibe, do some vibe skill, right, to create what kind of skill vibes with you and then put it up on a marketplace, right, to a share with your friends or, you know, or create these emergent skills. But I think that might be where it's going. And then last thing, I could talk about this for a while, but model distillation could play in that as well.
Okay, I'll let you have the last word here. I know you on the first conversation were maybe the most strong on, look, you're not going to use vibe coding to like build a bridge. I think Chris is maybe ending on a note of optimism. It's like maybe agents are the bridge that gets you there. Do you buy that story, or are you still a little bit skeptical about, you know, how far Rick Rubin can get?
I think humans are going to have to be in the loop more than just in the vibe coding step. So I completely agree. I think vibe coding to create something, kicking it over to an agent to iterate, build it out a little more detail, like all fair game, and is going to be pretty exciting. But I'm not ready to totally just kick out the human in the loop part of the process there, where they start at the beginning and then you just see what bridge pops out on the other end and walk across it blindly.
Seems like a fine bridge. Yeah. All my agents are telling me it's the best. So.
Yes, every agent agrees.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. Kate, Chris, Aaron, always great to have you on the show. And thanks all you listeners for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you next week on Mixture of Experts.